Good afternoon. I would like to invite you to take your Bibles, and you can start by turning along with me to the book of Hebrews and the 12th chapter. Hebrews chapter 12, we will read there together in just a moment. But I want to once again start off by thanking you for the opportunity to get to be with you this afternoon. I've been continuing to get to know several of you. Enjoyed our time together this afternoon, and it's good to see others who I have not yet met and those who are visiting tonight. It's always a great grace, and it is always a privilege to get to be with the people of God wherever we have that opportunity and to open up His Word together. As has already been mentioned, we've been trying to explore the topic of bitterness from, you may feel like, every conceivable angle, but I feel like it's a complex topic. And truly, at the end of tonight's lesson, when we begin to do some of our application, we're even going to look at a little bit more of the reasons behind why I feel that this is such an important study. But you may have been wondering how we could be three lessons in into bitterness without having gone to Hebrews chapter 12. And so we probably need to start tonight's lesson by looking at that text and rectify that real quick. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15, you'll recall that after exhorting the brethren to pursue peace, the author of Hebrews says, "See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled." Now, that's a relatively short verse, but I think there are a lot of important truths that are packed into those few words. And I think the first of those is that the text is letting us know right up front the seriousness with which we must take the topic of bitterness. You know, I said the other night that in going through this is not intended in any way to be, you know, just a talk about positivity or that we're somehow exploring, we just need to be more positive thinkers and put away negative thoughts. No, what the text says is that bitterness is something that can actually cause us to lose out and to miss out on the grace of God. And when we talk about subjects that might cause us to fall away, or as we mentioned the other night, be led away into apostasy, and we think about grievous sins that would somehow put us off the path and rob us of our salvation, I don't know that we always put bitterness right up at the top of that list, and yet here the author is saying that this is something that not only can cause us to miss out on the grace of God, but it is something that causes others to be defiled as well. But I think that in those few words, we're also told something about the nature of bitterness, how it operates and how it spreads. You'll notice in the text that bitterness is described as a root. And I hope I'm not stretching the metaphor too far, but I think that is descriptive of the way in which bitterness takes hold and the way in which it operates. Bitterness is something that often lies beneath the surface. Now, maybe after it's been there for so long, it has bubbled up and you can sort of feel that palpable sense of tension that is a result of bitterness, but that's only after it has already taken root and it is buried deep below. And so it lies there unseen until eventually it breaks through the ground and causes problems. But I think the second thing that we can maybe ascribe to that metaphor is that there's really no telling just how far and how wide bitterness might spread. Those roots tend to grow deep, and they tend to grow much further than we might first estimate. Now, that's a pretty common illustration in the Old Testament. Bitterness and sin, they're described as weeds. They're described as wormwood. These are plants that burrow under, and instead of bringing forth good fruit, they bring forth wickedness. They bring forth bitter fruit. You may remember something like Deuteronomy chapter 29, where as Moses is instructing people on how to guard their hearts once they enter into the land, he says in verse 18, in a little bit of a different context, that there will not be among you a man or a woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations, that there will not be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood." Now, in the context, he's talking about idolatry and other things, but it's that same imagery. And that's really the point that we're trying to begin with, is that bitterness is something that is insidious, and it is something that is infectious. It spreads, it burrows down, and causes harm to other people. Now, in an effort for us to cultivate a better understanding and appreciation of those points, and how we can guard against it, what we're going to do this afternoon is look at the text of Numbers chapter 16. So Numbers chapter 16, if you'll start turning along there with me, the first observation that we're going to be making is that bitterness grows in the midst of difficulty. And particularly, I want to begin this thought by considering something that we mentioned in our first lesson, and that is the importance of choice. And I want us to think about that statement, that bitterness is a choice. You know, one of the most perhaps well-known passages in talking about difficulty and hard times is James chapter 1. And of course, you'll remember what he says there, that you know, when we encounter various trials, we are to count it all joy because we know the result of those things, a more mature, a more perfect faith. And yet, I think something that we need to ensure that we are appreciating is that what James is describing is not our default setting. And that's why he's having to tell us those things. We don't naturally encounter difficulty and things that are unpleasant and things that might rob us of joy and automatically say, "Oh yes, what an opportunity for growth I've been presented with today. I know God's going to do great things with this." Now maybe that's where your faith is, but personally speaking, when I have trials, I have to remind myself of what James tells us to do. So again, that's not our default setting. And in fact, we might just have two possible choices there. And there's one in which we are more predisposed to take. So we can either choose joy, or I can choose to take the other path. That's the opposite of joy. That's going down a path that becomes bitter. And I want to make that observation because we're going to be looking at the rebellion of Korah in Numbers chapter 16. And if you're already familiar with what takes place in that text, I want us to appreciate that the actions of Korah and the actions of the people who were with him, those things did not take place in a vacuum. There were things that happened that led up to the point of rebellion on the part of Korah and his cohorts. You'll remember in Numbers chapter 13 and 14, the nation has been met with this awful and complete failure to go in and take the land. And as a result of that, they've been given the even worse news that you're not even going to get to try to take the land. You're going to have to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until all of this generation has died out. And then you'll remember that after that, they're met with another disaster because they don't believe it. No, we can go in, we can take the land. And they try to, and they are thoroughly defeated. And they have to limp away from that encounter with more shame and embarrassment. Now, immediately after that, at least in the text, I don't know how much time has passed, but in Numbers chapter 15, the congregation is instructed to execute a man by stoning for breaking the Sabbath. And I think even after all of these things, and even after what we're going to look at for Korah and his story, we'll see that in verse 41 of chapter 16, Israel responds very poorly to his punishment as well. So I'm just trying to remind us of some of the things that lead up to this story. Understand, you know, I'm not trying to portray Korah as sort of the sympathetic villain of the story. He's not a sympathetic figure. But I want us to grasp the circumstances and the environment, sort of the national mood at the time, if you will. Because this is not just some handful of malcontents that pop up here and there and say, we don't like the way things are being run. As we'll see in a moment, this includes a great portion of the assembly. This includes those who are in a position of leadership. And this includes a large portion of the assembly as well. So in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1, we find Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. They assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough. For all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Now again, think about the events that have taken place leading up to this, you know, grand speechification on the part of Korah. The climate, you know, there was no, you know, Israel News 1 or whatever to tune into. But the climate, the discussion that would have been on everyone's lips was one of spiritual and physical failure. The trip to the Promised Land had really just been the record of, you know, one crisis after another. They had left Egypt in sort of, you know, this dramatic rocket blast-off fashion. You know, they plundered the Egyptians. They've left with servants and livestock and all of this wealth. And then the army of Egypt is wiped out in the Red Sea. And things are really, you know, going red hot. And then you just have one failure after another. It has sputtered and fallen. And people are dying left and right, and they haven't even gotten into the land yet. They made themselves a calf, and people died as a result. They were told that they couldn't enter the land, and then more people died. And if you wanted to be very cynical about it, regarding the Sabbath breaker, now people are dying just because they went out and picked up some sticks. This is horrible. This is a terrible situation. Now, you know as well as I do that there were certain ones who saw these things, people like Joshua, people like Caleb, and the result was that their faith grew stronger. Those trials caused their faith to become more mature and perfect. And yet, for men like Korah, you have a compounding of problems one after another. And that is paired with a lack of a willingness to take any responsibility on their part for being a cause of the problem. And so what does that produce? Well, things are awful. Things are difficult. Somebody has to be to blame. Now, I know it's not me, and it's not you. So who's to blame? And so what they begin to do, and what we often begin to do, is that we start to look for all of the cracks, all of the divides. And instead of moving forward with an attitude of grace and understanding where we can heal and reconcile, bitterness drives us to deepen those divides. In an effort to shift blame and responsibility, or even if I'm not the one who is the cause of the problem, because I don't want to be the one who will help with the problem, I look for a place to identify blame and deepen those divides. And so we want to start this study by establishing that the soil, and we might say there are many types, but the soil in which bitterness can grow so easily and take that deep root is the soil that is in difficult times. But I think there are some other things that are revealed to us in our text. Let's drop down to about verse 12 in Numbers chapter 16. Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, "We will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness? But you would also lord it over us? Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." Now, I don't want to give these guys any more credit than they are due, but I feel like we can at least hand it to them that they are pretty good at making speeches. I think it's a bit of a silly speech. You've taken us out of a land of milk and honey. I think they're referring to Egypt again. You've taken us out of the place where things were great. You've brought us out here to die. And again, I just think it's so funny, the conclusion that they've reached. We talked about paranoia last night. We know what you're up to. You're just going to bring us out there and you're going to poke out our eyes. I don't know what Moses did at that. Maybe he laughed. Maybe he probably didn't. But I think that one thing that's introduced to us in this text is that bitterness really doesn't have any substance behind it. You know, think about every instance in which someone has convinced themselves, or they have been convinced, that something was being withheld from them. And so they act on it, and they reach out and they take hold of the thing that they have supposedly been denied up to this point. And then they have that moment where they have to ask, well, now what am I supposed to do? You know, think about the individual who has become bitter and unsatisfied in their marriage. And they think, I don't have the relationship I deserve. I don't have the spouse I want. I deserve something better. And then they step out of that marriage and they have to ask, now what? Or that person who, you know, maybe they're fed up. They don't think they're getting the respect that they deserve, and so I'm going to be treated better somewhere else, and they just walk off the job with no plan as to what happens next. Or, you know, maybe something a little less serious. You have a child who says, I don't have to put up with this. I'm going to run away from home. And so they get out their handkerchief and put belongings on the end of a stick, and they start walking out, and you say, all right, you know, write us a postcard. And then they get to the end of the driveway, and they have to ask the question, well, what am I going to do now? Because there really wasn't a plan for what was going to come after. There really wasn't any destination at which they were going to arrive. They were convinced that their situation was just untenable, and they demanded that change was just going to have to take place. But then there's that moment where they finally open that door just to see what's on the other side, and it is empty. There's nothing there. I think that's what we read about in Genesis chapter 3, where the serpent is tempting Eve, and look at all that's being withheld from you. Here's everything that you can have if you just reach out and take what is yours. And I don't know if realization came on them in just the blink of an eye or how it happened, but at some point they knew what they had done. And that awful realization fell on their shoulders all at once. Now, I think that one of the interesting things in this very interesting text is that while God does require the life of Korah and others, it's not an instantaneous reaction. like with Nadab and Abihu, where they offer the strange fire and it comes out of their censers and kills them on the spot. God allows for these men to have a confrontation with Moses. Think about that. Now, you know from the story later on that ultimately this contest is going to be decided by divine mandate. And yet, how often do people come up and say, I am going to challenge the messenger of God? And the response is, all right, well, come on up. Let's see what you have to say. And yet that's what happens here. Moses calls them forth, but notice in our text what they say. We're not coming. We're not going to come down there and talk. You're just going to poke out our eyes. Why do you suppose they said that? Did they have any solutions to the problem? Did they have any real answers for change at leadership in Israel? No, all they had was criticism. And I think that God puts that on display by allowing them to be brought forth, or at least the invitation given for them to be brought forth. If we understood how empty bitterness really was, we just wouldn't be tempted by it like we sometimes are. Bitterness is so good at finding faults. Bitterness gives us sort of this superpower vision for finding problems with people and finding problems in the congregation, things that aren't being done just the right way. And I think that we would be of necessitation to honesty to say that that's not always a fabrication, that sometimes there really are issues. You know, Moses was not a perfect leader. There were times where Moses really messed up. But what bitterness fails to do is offer any kind of a solution. And that's because bitterness isn't interested in solutions. Bitterness only wants to tear things down. But it can't do it on its own. In chapter 16 and verse 41, this is after Korah has been punished. On the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." Now, have you ever read anything more ridiculous in your life? Moses and Aaron are just, you know, kind of sitting there minding their own business, and here comes this mob of people yelling, "You're out here trying to kill us and poke out our eyes." And then God punishes them. And instead of learning anything, now the congregation, "You killed these men." As though Moses could cause the earth to open up and swallow up a whole encampment of people. How do you suppose that they got to that point? I think that something is revealed in verse 41. And what is being revealed is the depth at which this bitterness had taken root. You know, at the start of the chapter, we see that Korah knew what he was doing. He didn't try to do this alone. He gathered up a group of 250 people. And we see just how far that attitude had spread in verse 41. But we also see that his recruitment was kind of selective. If you remember in those first three verses, the people that he gathered around him, first of all, they were men of reputation, those that people would respect, and they were also leaders in Israel. You know, as a lone voice, just one man, Korah can be ignored. He can be contained. He's bitter, but he's alone. But you get a group of influential people together. You get some movers and shakers to present this united front, and now Korah's rebellion looks impressive. It looks legitimate. These aren't rebels, these are problem solvers. I believe there's a reason why Paul instructs Titus in Titus chapter 3 and verse 10 to reject a factious or contentious man after just two warnings. Now, I understand that the word in that specific text may be referring to those who are holding different doctrines or teachings, but I think the principle still applies. The root for the word in the text is one who is causing schisms, one who is causing divisions. And what Paul says is that you cannot afford to treat that kind of a situation as someone who is just a little weak, they just need a little patience, you know, a little word here and there, because once those cracks are opened up, they get wide in a hurry. It doesn't take much time for this kind of a thing to spread. Bitterness operates in that way. It might start with just one or two people, but it doesn't take long before it begins to spread. And after it has gotten in deep enough that it can produce that sour fruit, it's created the divide. And then what you have is a situation where it is us and it is them, and one of us has got to go. Now, I want us to think about some ways in which we can apply those thoughts. The idea of guarding your heart. This is something that a friend of ours has said to us over the years in different situations. And I don't think it's trite or cheesy or just some sort of, again, something you might crochet and put up on the wall. But bitterness and looking for a place to take root, if we are not on guard, can dig deep and bury itself quickly in our hearts. When we are the ones who are struggling with bitter attitudes, our responsibility, aside from reconciliation with any individuals or any situation, if we can put it generically, is that we have to look to God for healing. Because, you know, a basic truth is when we're working with people, we're working with those who are imperfect, ourselves included, and even when we try to reconcile with others, even when we try to reconcile with a situation, it may not be that we walk away and feel like that was 100%, both sides checked every box of what they were looking for, everyone is happy and satisfied. Not every situation works that way. So what do you do next? Do you move on? Do you say we've done what we could, we've made right what we can, now it's time to move forward? Or do you continue to let it harbor in your heart? Do you continue to let it grow and grow? I think that perhaps in another context, there's some wisdom to take away from what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13 when he talks about love enduring and bearing up under all things. Again, he's not just talking about love making it through difficult times in a passage that is specifically talking about relationships within the church. Those words are also speaking about our ability to simply dismiss those things that are not worth it. Now understand, I'm not talking about turning a blind eye towards sin. But you know what? Sometimes people say things and they just weren't thinking. Or sometimes people do things and they're not aware of how it affects others. And I can make the choice to say, they did that, they did it knowing what they were doing, it was directed at me, and I know how they meant it. Or I can say, well, you know, that was a little weird, but I know that brother, or I know that sister, and that's probably not what they meant. Or if they did, there must have been something extenuating behind their circumstance for them to say it. Maybe I need to reach out, see if they need help. But I think as a part of that, in guarding our hearts, we also have the responsibility to be the keeper of our brethren. And we have to help guard the hearts of others. I was talking with Jeremy, I think yesterday, and kind of a hard lesson for me to learn, because I'm someone who likes to joke, is that joking is kind of an avenue for bitter people to put out feelers. You know, maybe you've had a conversation with someone, and maybe you were talking about me or Jeremy, and you said, "You know what? I don't get the whole bearded, bald, and beautiful look. I mean, we can't help it. It's just the way it is." And then someone else says, "Yeah, that's right. I mean, what's with those guys? I mean, they look like they just stepped out of some sort of Amish time machine that was probably powered by horses and sunlight, and then just kind of goes off in a tear." And, you know, you think, "Man, I was just making a joke." But you really found something there in the way that they reacted. And sometimes they are the ones who are putting out the feelers. You know, "Hey, what do you think about old bald Jeremy? What do you think about that?" And then depending on how you respond, maybe they go a little further. Have you had those conversations before? We need to be watching the way that others talk, and I'm not talking about some sort of thought police situation, but we need to be aware. And there are signs when we can see other people slipping into bitterness. What did you think about this decision that the elders made? Did you approve of that? Or what did you think about the way that this brother gave a Wednesday night invitation? Or have you been brought over some dinner by Sister So-and-so when you were sick? And it just kind of goes on and on. So we have to guard the hearts of others as well. And I think paired with that, we have to have a determination to be as much of the solution as we can be. Again, one of the, this afternoon, when we were over at the meal, there was some toy that fell on the floor at the bottom of the stairs. And I was looking at it, and I just wanted to see how many kids were going to step over it and not pick it up. It was a great number. And then the adults started coming in too. And I don't know if no one saw it. It looked like some people intentionally went out of their way to not step on it. But, you know, it was maybe the 17th person to step over that thing before someone said, "You know, let me pick this up." And that's kind of the way that we are with problems, isn't it? You know, here's something that I don't like. Here's something that I see should have been done. And what bitterness starts to say is somebody really ought to do something about that. And if someone doesn't do something about it, well, then that means that people here aren't spiritually minded, or people here don't appreciate me, and the list just kind of goes on. You know, it would be kind of wonderful, wouldn't it, if any time someone saw a problem, if it was within their power to solve it, they just did the thing that needed to be done. Now, we understand that there are some problems that are above our pay grade. And that's why we have shepherds and leadership within the congregation. And the same thing applies there. Instead of sitting back and thinking about all of the issues and just pointing them out, maybe we need to take those things to the elders. Say, "Here's a concern. I don't know what to do. I'm willing to help. If there's a way you can use me, but I just want to make sure this doesn't turn into a bigger problem." But the last thing I would say, and I really want to connect this with Cora, is that you are never as important as bitter people say that you are. Bitterness, again, cannot spread on its own. It needs other people. And bitterness in and of itself is not always an attractive banner. You know, if someone got up and made an announcement after services, "You know, everyone, I was thinking about splitting this congregation wide open. I really want to cause some trouble, want to cause some strife in some families. I'm going to put up a sign-up sheet on the back bulletin board. If anybody wants to meet, we'll be at Denny's afterward." Probably not going to get a lot of people on the sign-up sheet. But, you know, if you sit down and you say, "Man, I've been seeing some problems, and you're a spiritual person. You're a, you're a stable-minded individual, and I just want to run some of these things past you and see what you think. Well, that's a horse of a different color. You know, when Summer and I first got married, she was teaching school, I was building cabinets, but you know, we were both very young, and we were at a congregation where there were not elders. There was an evangelist there that was unfortunately receiving a lot of criticism from a few in the congregation. And at the same time, there were just a lot of members with issues. And there was one fella who was living with his girlfriend. He was working as a bouncer at the bar. He was back on drugs and alcohol. We hadn't seen him in 4 months. But we were refusing to withdraw fellowship, which at the time was kind of a silly notion. It would have been more of a exercise in spiritual geography to just acknowledge that he's over there and we're over here. But, you know, I spoke up in a men's meeting. I actually called one and said, you know, I have a problem with us communicating to the congregation that, you know, we think that this guy's still working on it and maybe he's going to come back. Now, I mentioned that to say that after I had said that, one of the quote-unquote movers and shakers in the church took me to lunch, which, hey, you know, we're newly married, poor, broke, you know, free lunch is always great. And we sit down and he's talking about, you know, how spiritual I am and how thoughtful I am. And he said, you know, about that men's meeting the other day, you never want to be the guy who's just always speaking up in men's meetings because then no one will listen to you when it really counts. Now soon, we're going to call a meeting and we're going to get this preacher fired. And we need everyone to be saving up their influence and their ammunition so that when that meeting comes, we can get him out of there. Now, there are a lot of things that are ridiculous about that situation, not the least of which is the idea that I was such a paragon of influence and deep thought that I was going to be the one who swayed the congregation on this issue. I happen to like the guy. But the other was how blinded by bitterness this individual was, that here's someone who's shacking up, drinking, drugging, bouncing at a bar, and we've got all the patience in the world for him, but we don't like this preacher. So save it up, because we're going to run him out of town on a rail. Now, I don't know if you've had experiences like that or not. I tend to think you probably have. If I can have them, you know, at 20 years old, surely you can by now as well. But those are real stories. Those aren't just hypotheticals. That's where bitterness can get you. It can get you at some silly plot at the Logan's Roadhouse, or it can get you with 250 people standing in front of God's anointed leader saying, "We think that we can do better." Is it any wonder that the author of Hebrews calls back to this time in Israel's history to warn us about bitterness taking root, about it springing up, defiling many, and worst of all, causing us and others to miss out on the grace of God. God intends for His people to be a blessing. He wants to bless us, and He wants us to, in turn, bless others. Bitterness wants to derail that whole prospect. And yet, as we get ready to sing together and we extend the invitation, we want to remind all of those here that the Lord stands ready to bless you. Those who respond to the call of the gospel have your sins forgiven. And then what He has in mind for you is a life where you live as a blessing to others, an influence for good, someone who heals. But as we've read tonight, that's not always what we do. And sometimes attitudes like this take root. They pull us away from what God had in mind. And we need to repent. We need to ask for forgiveness Sometimes that's something that we want prayers from our brethren in a special way as we find ourselves continuing to struggle. And so this afternoon, if we can help you, if we can encourage you in a spiritual way, the invitation is yours while we ready ourselves to stand and sing.